This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Richard Osijo, a host on New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. And this interview is being done in partnership with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. Joining me today is Elizabeth Corver Glenn, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of New Mexico. And today she's going to talk about her recent book, Race Brokers: Housing Markets and Segregation in 21st Century Urban America, an examination of how racism in the real estate industry contributes to racial segregation and thereby racial inequality in cities today. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, great. So I wonder if you could just start by telling us briefly about your background, specifically, you know, how you came to work on this project and write this book.
Sure. So the sort of the seeds for this project were planted very early on when I was a graduate student at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And I was starting to do a lot of reading, as graduate students do, and hopefully faculty as well, and was becoming more and more convinced that racial segregation was something I really wanted to study. I viewed it as the kind of the cornerstone of systemic racial inequities in our society, in American society. And at the same time, my spouse and I went through the process of purchasing our first home in an urban Houston neighborhood. And the process was extremely overwhelming and entailed numerous interactions with all kinds of real estate professionals, including real estate agents, mortgage bankers, inspectors, appraisers, and so on. And so kind of the confluence of those two things, you know, being immersed in the literature on racial segregation, which, as I'm guessing many of your listeners know, has been studied in depth for a very long time, and my own personal experience of going through that process and realizing that there was actually a pretty big gap in some of the racial segregation literature, really missing kind of how real estate professionals continue to matter in the post-fair housing era, and specifically in shaping housing opportunities and outcomes. So the project was kind of evolved from that confluence of dynamics, and eventually became what was my doctoral dissertation, and then evolved even further into the book.
Great. Thank you. I think like a lot of readers, I certainly recalled a lot of my own personal home buying experiences as I read this book and found a lot of connections with it. It was really fascinating. So you start the book by briefly profiling and quoting four real estate agents in Houston, and they speak about different neighborhoods and different circumstances, but they all use the word natural to describe real estate and real estate market. One says that it's a natural progression that a Latinx neighborhood will change as white hipsters move in. Two of them say that it's natural for racial groups to want to live near people who look like them. And then another says that the relationship between rising home values and an influx of white homeowners is also a natural progression. And you use these examples to show how racial housing segregation has become so pervasive that it has become naturalized or just perceived as the natural order of real estate, the way that it's just going to be. And your book here is intervening by showing the important role that real estate professionals, the actual people, not, you know, any kind of natural forces, play in creating and maintaining racial segregation. So start, please, by telling us why racial segregation matters so much, just in general, how we got to this point of such advanced levels of housing inequality by race in the U.S., and how these real estate professionals are important for understanding this process.
Sure. So racial segregation, as Professor Monica Bell and many others have argued, is one of the primary tools that is used as a weapon of white supremacy in American society. It's a tool used by people in all kinds of sectors, from education to policing to employment to transportation, urban planning to healthcare to businesses and retails. It's a tool that's used by actors in those industries and organizations to actively oppress individuals and communities of color, and to accrue advantages and value to white communities and white individuals. And so that's why it's so important. It's as a major tool of white supremacy and the broader system of racial inequality and racism in the United States. It's kind of at the middle of it all. If it's dismantled, if it's chipped away at, perhaps we can actually begin to see some change in some of these other arenas as well. How we got here? Well, I think there's a lot of ways we could go with that, but one of the primary ones I like to talk about is the confluence of public policy and private industry throughout the 20th century, and as my book demonstrates, into the 21st century. Public policy and private industry, including the real estate industries I cover in the book, the real estate brokerage industry, housing development, mortgage banking and lending, and appraising, all used explicitly racist policies and practices from the inception of the kind of the modern housing market in the 1930s, and continue to this day, specifically using the logics of racial difference, distinction, and hierarchy to constitute that market. And so really, I could get into more detail, but I think one of the stories that's been told many times now, including by Monica Bell, by Kianga Yamada-Taylor, by Richard Rothstein and many others, is that this confluence of public policy and private industry, along with just everyday housing consumers, people who buy homes and so on, follow these racist logics of difference, and then naturalize that difference to the point where we now have very durable racial segregation, and to the point where, as you noted, the professionals in my study regularly referred to it as a natural condition, and you did so as they sort of deflected their own role in maintaining racial segregation as a condition of as a kind of a an outcome of that market and their own actions in it.
Great, thank you. Now let's get into these professionals now, and we'll start with the title, which is also the key concept you're using here to make sense of these folks. Mm-hmm. So you define race brokers, it comes on pages 11 and 12, as gatekeeping individuals in any social sphere who are more influential than most other people in shaping what race means, whether and how ideas about race are connected to resources. Close quote. So this is a really valuable concept, I think, that we can apply to a lot of different situations. And given the stakes involved, the real estate industry is a perfect locus for seeing it. Now, each of the professionals you study, and you mentioned they are the housing developers, real estate agents, mortgage bankers, and appraisers, they're all intermediaries within the real estate industry. They're all well-positioned in between distinct actors with the power to make their ideas about race really kind of stick to housing and the housing market. And you argue that the dominant racial frame you found these professionals are using is what you call the racist market rubric, which enables them to perceive the people and neighborhoods they encounter in specific ways that favors whites and whiteness and majority white neighborhoods. So walk us through this concept a bit, like how you came up with this idea of race brokers, how it describes the people in the real estate industry, as well as this rubric, what it is and how these brokers use it.
Sure. So part of the impetus for the project more broadly was kind of thinking about some of the gaps in the sociology of race and ethnicity, which has, as others have noted, largely focused on kind of like systemic structural racism and then kind of individual level racism and discrimination, and has kind of missed the sort of middle of how structures and individuals come together. And there have been some really important interventions recently along those lines, including Victor Ray's theory of racialized organizations, which I draw on in the book. But even before that piece came out, I was trying to think about how do we connect structures and individuals? Where are the missing pieces? And I started doing a lot of reading and surveying of the literature and thinking about people who are really influential. They are gatekeepers, whether they're gatekeeping resources like material resources, or they're gatekeeping social resources, including like social connections. I bring both of those kinds of resources together in the book and show how real estate professionals are connecting people or disconnecting people. They're connecting resources, other kinds of resources like land and the socially constructed value to specific people and neighborhoods, and show how these very important people are one way that we can think about sort of the middles of racialization and racism in American society. These intermediaries who are not just the average person out, you know, going for a walk, but rather have access to the resources and the knowledge that allows them to shape outcomes and opportunities in very powerful ways. So that's a little bit of kind of how I came to that. In terms of the rubrics I talk about in the book, that was really an emergent kind of outcome of the analysis that I did of all the data that I gathered. And I coded, recoded, and coded again all of the more than 100 in-depth interviews I gathered, the hundreds of pages of ethnographic field notes that I took with 13 different real estate agents and housing developers. And these were the predominant ways that real estate professionals in the study connected ideas about race to market activity, right? So specifically how they reflected on race and with respect to the work that they did in their everyday lives. And as I discuss in the book, and as you pointed out, the racist market rubric was absolutely the dominant rubric and was pretty much the only one used by the white professionals. And these basically were racist ideas that these white professionals, these intermediaries, connected to their daily work and used to make decisions about who to try to network with, or how to market a home, or where to purchase land for development, or how much to appraise a home's value at. And so that's why I call it a rubric, right? It's almost like an evaluative sort of tool that these professionals were using.
Yeah, and another important contribution your book makes is its discovery of an alternative racial frame that some real estate professionals in your sample use. So instead of the racist market rubric, some of these professionals, a subset, and they're usually people of color, use what you call a people-oriented market rubric. And as a result, you refer to these folks not as race brokers, but race breakers, or people who are breakers of racism in the housing market. So how does this rubric contrast with the more common racist market one? And what are these professionals trying to accomplish that's different from the larger group of people in your sample?
Sure. So the people-oriented market rubric was really kind of the primary way that some of the professionals of color in my study evaluated their clients, evaluated their work, and made decisions about with whom they would work with and where they would work and so on. And this rubric really was just such a stark contrast to the racist market rubric, because people who used it were actually affirming of the cultural, the moral, the social, the economic value of people of color alongside that of white folks and white neighborhoods. And I really used this sort of people-affirming, a people-oriented approach to discern what they did in their professional work. And for many of them, this was, and as I discuss in the book, this was really influenced by their own experiences of discrimination, whether in the housing market or in other spheres. Several of them reflected on, you know, discrimination they had experienced. In fact, one example in the book, I talk about a real estate broker who herself had been a victim of a predatory mortgage loan. And that actually shaped not only the fact that she was actively trying to work with communities of color and home buyers of color, but also the specific mortgage bankers that she was willing to refer them to, because she didn't want them to experience the same kind of discrimination that she had experienced, right? And so the people-oriented market rubric was a kind of a counter way of trying to engage housing market work. But as I discuss in the book, you know, there were limitations, right, to the extent to which a people-oriented market rubric could actually kind of undermine the broader racialized logic of the contemporary housing market, precisely because it's not just professionals, right, that are doing the work. It's these real estate organizations, it's industries themselves that are imposing racist and economic incentives that make racist housing work lucrative, right? And so there were limitations in the extent to which these professionals of color who drew on the people-oriented housing, the people-oriented market rubric, could actually kind of change the sort of the contours of the market, because these individuals alone can't undo the broader sort of logics and methods of the market more generally.
Oh, great. Thank you for that. So before we go into your findings in greater depth, tell us a bit about Houston, the city that you focus on, and some of its neighborhoods. What is its particular local history of racial segregation, and what does its housing market look like today?
Sure. So Houston is the most ethno-racially diverse city in the United States today. And it has been heading towards that trajectory for quite some time. It is a rapidly growing major city, and it's often touted as kind of like the cosmopolitan sort of future of urban America. And at the same time, it's has a long history of racial segregation, Black-white segregation and Latinx-white segregation are both remain quite high into the 21st century. And this is despite the fact that Houston has several characteristics that would, you know, sort of theoretically lead to sort of lower levels of segregation, including affordable housing. So, you know, there are higher proportions of people of color in Houston who own their homes than in places like Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York, for example. Or another thing that people often point to is that, you know, Houston doesn't have a master zoning plan, right? It's not got this sort of like centralized plan that some folks have theorized might be related to sort of increased segregation. But what Houston does have is an extremely micromanaged kind of zoning called deed restrictions. And it is the most deed restricted major city in the U.S. The last I checked. So there are these other kind of local things that really matter. And so, yeah, you know, despite the fact that it's a very diverse city, that it's had much greater success in terms of access to home ownership for communities of color and so on. Nevertheless, it has high levels of racial segregation and other forms of housing inequality.
All right, thank you. So let's get to this first group of real estate professionals that you discuss, and these are the housing developers. Quite simply, these are the folks who build homes. They plan them, they construct them, and so on, but they have to decide which neighborhood and which plot of land to build on. And these have important implications for racial segregation, as you discuss. Now, these folks, they often use economic justifications for the decisions they make, but you show the important role that racist rationales play in these decisions. So how do we see these rubrics, the racist market and the people-oriented ones, used among housing developers, and what impacts do they have?
Sure. So the housing developers in my study predominantly, almost exclusively actually, use the racist market rubric at kind of two different levels of decision making. The first one being the neighborhood level. So when they're first deciding where to build in urban areas, Houston developers look at, okay, which neighborhoods do we want to build in? And overwhelmingly, the developers in my study chose to build or develop new homes in already existing white neighborhoods or in neighborhoods they thought would be attractive to white folks. At times, these were Latinx areas or kind of areas that bordered already white areas. And they made these justifications by basically assuming that white neighborhoods were the most desirable, that white homebuyers would want to purchase homes in white neighborhoods, and that white buyers were the kinds of clients that they wanted to kind of cater to. And then developers, once they kind of decided, you know, here's where I want to build, they also made a kind of individual kind of plot level decision. So plot of land level decisions. And here, they often targeted homeowners of color, doing what I call and what others have called reverse blockbusting, to really prey on homeowners of color and immigrant homeowners, assuming that these individuals would have less knowledge about the housing market, that they would be more gullible, and so on, other racist ideas about them, to really use a variety of strategies to try to purchase their homes or their land for below market price, so that they could then develop it and sell it for a much higher and inflated price to white families who would then move in.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's just fascinating to read more about these folks who are often hidden. So the second group you study, though, they're the people who most readers may think about when they think about brokerage and real estate, and they are the actual real estate brokers or the agents. So you start by talking about what appear to be very race-neutral organizational routines that these real estate agents use. They network, they have a percentage-based commission system, they market, they have different ways that they try to manage the various risks that come within the real estate industry. And these all sound like very practical ways that they would handle all the different market pressures that they encounter. But in practice, you found that most agents interpreted these pressures and accomplished their jobs through this racist market frame. And for this one, I found the differences between the white and non-white agents to be quite striking when it came to how they interpret these routines, especially this practice of pocket listings. So tell us how these brokers operate and how they engage with these routines differently.
Sure. So this is the chapter that, and when I talk about real estate agents and so on, this is a chapter I try to bring in some of the newer work on racialized organizations and talk about how real estate brokerages really pressure real estate agents to build their businesses and be profitable in specific ways that become actually pretty overtly racialized. So real estate brokerages routinely pressured real estate agents to build build their business through networking, and at the same time they pressured agents to conform to a standard percentage-based commission, as you mentioned. And when those two dynamics came together, sort of the pressure of networking and the pressure of the percentage-based commission, this is how those sort of pressures became racialized, because the percentage-based commission means that real estate agents are paid more if the homes that they're selling or the homes that their buyers are buying are more expensive. And at the same time, in white agents' case, predominantly, their networks are white. And so when you bring those two dynamics together, white real estate agents, they're already they're already networking with other professionals and consumers who are white. But then when you add the layer of, and they're also looking to find clients who are quote unquote higher value, those two things come together to ensure that white agents basically are pressured to network with white people. And they do. And this is exactly how they acted. And time after time, I observed white real estate agents actively trying to network with other white people, specifically clients or customers, and avoid customers or clients of color. And so this is related, like the percentage-based commission, I'm guessing we'll get to this a little bit later, but the percentage-based commission is one of the ways that I found that sort of the existing sort of structure of neighborhood racial economic inequality gets reinscribed into contemporary housing market practices, right? So you have this long history of unequal home values across neighborhoods that have different racial compositions. So higher values in white neighborhoods and lower values in communities of color. And so even if those values weren't continuing to be racialized or exacerbated, which we'll talk about later if that is happening. But even if it weren't, sort of the history of unequal home values would be getting sort of baked into the percentage-based commission in ways that incentivize real estate agents to work with clients and people who are trying to buy homes or sell homes in white neighborhoods. And so in the book, I talk about, you know, how they do their networking in this racialized way, and then how they maintain their networks. And white agents maintain their networks by maintaining trust with their clients. And part of this maintaining trust means sort of sweeping the racism that they observed from their clients or from others under the rug by not actually stopping to work with clients or people that were actively racist, by just kind of going along with what consumers wanted, and by themselves actually introducing racism into the process if they thought that was going to make their clients happy. And then by contrast, real estate agents of color, several of them actively tried to work against some of these dynamics by specifically networking with other individuals of color. Some of them also adopted alternative pay structures. So some of them adopted like a flat fee instead of the percentage-based commission, and really kind of tried to ensure that they weren't unfairly kind of disadvantaging home buyers or home sellers of color, in part because, as I mentioned earlier, they themselves had often experienced some of that discrimination and disadvantage in their own lives. And then with respect to pocket listings, I shift a little bit and I talk less about organizational pressures and I talk more about organizational silence. So pocket listings are what many in the real estate brokerage industry call home sales or listings that are not placed publicly on the multiple listing service. Instead, these are private listings that real estate agents and real estate brokers will advertise basically to their networks, right? And they'll send them out on maybe like a social media, or they'll send out an email and say, hey, you know, I've got the exclusive on this house. The sellers, you know, don't want to put it up for sale on publicly on the market, but I know about it. And so here you go. Here's the insider information. And of course, for white agents who, in my study, found what was almost exclusively white agents who used these pocket listings, that means, of course, given the dynamics of racialized networking and networks, as I call them, networks of value, they're sending these pocket listings almost exclusively to potential white home buyers or other white people in their networks, and disproportionately excluding individuals of color and real estate professionals of color from even knowing that those listings exist. And on this particular issue, the Houston Association of Realtors and other real estate organizations were silent during the research. Recently, after the, you know, sort of the study ended a couple of years ago, the National Association of Realtors issued a rule against pocket listings. But as far as I can tell, and in conversations with others in the industry, that rule doesn't have any sort of meaningful consequences for folks who do engage them. So it's still it's still a common practice. And at the time that I conducted the study, it was a practice that it was just allowed to happen. And organizations were pretty much silent on sort of the ramifications of pocket listings for racial equity and fair housing concerns.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, and I thought the fact that some of the agents of color who you studied had never even heard of pocket listings before you brought it up to them, which I thought was very spoke volumes when I read that. So the next two groups of real estate professionals, they also might not be who come to mind when readers think about real estate, but who nonetheless are playing very indelible roles in racial segregation. And these are the mortgage bankers and the appraisers. So the bankers are the money lenders, and these are the people who process loan applications for approval by a bank and bank's underwriters. And these folks work really closely, you show, with real estate agents who regularly recommend home buyers to them. But these relationships represent what you call segregated inter-industry networking, or racially segregated professional and client networks that exclude racial minority agents and home buyers. And relatedly, they use what you call racialized discretion to decide whether and how to work with home buyers and to interpret loan applications. So it's this really fascinating look inside a black box in the industry. So walk us through this process and the important roles networks and racialized discretion play in money lending for mortgages.
Sure. So I was very grateful to be able to draw on a couple of decades worth of research on mortgage loan inequality to help kind of interpret what I observed in my fieldwork and in the interviews on mortgage bankers and mortgage loan inequality. And the sort of the consensus about mortgage loan inequality in the 21st century is that it's a big problem. It was a growing problem in the lead up to the housing crash, and it persists as a problem in the wake of the housing crash up until the present. And so, part of what I was trying to understand was, you know, how does that inequality emerge if we're, you know, because a mortgage loan application doesn't occur in a vacuum, right? It's not just someone wakes up one day and is like, oh, I'm going to go fill out a mortgage loan application. It's what is the process of the mortgage loan? And so that's kind of how I came to this particular set of findings. And what I found was, as you mentioned, mortgage bankers actively, particularly white mortgage bankers, actively tried to network with white real estate agents using the same logics. Again, this is a racist market rubric, was throughout present across all of the sort of the industries and the professionals that I studied. And they were actively seeking to network with white real estate agents because they reasoned that, you know, white real estate agents would bring them to white home buyers. And they also thought that these buyers would be more likely to be profitable for them, would be lower risk, would be more likely to have a successful loan application, would be more likely to ensure that they got paid, right? And so time after time, I observed white mortgage bankers networking with white real estate agents and white home buyers, and vice versa, because white real estate agents also thought that sort of recommending mortgage loan services to their clients was kind of a good service to ensure that they kind of stayed ahead of the competition. And so really, I found that before mortgage borrowers, before home buyers ever sit down to fill out an application, many times they are being channeled into these racially distinct mortgage banker and client relationships precisely because of the behind-the-scenes inter-industry networking that most buyers and sellers aren't observing or privy to in their home buying or selling process. And then I also found that mortgage bankers used a racialized discretion to interpret both borrower risk, and that's something that's not surprising given what we know about mortgage loan inequality through the many sort of quantitative studies that have looked at those inequities over the last 20 years. And I showed how that happens, like how do people interpret mortgage borrowers and use different sort of signals and cues from the mortgage loan application to impose that sort of racialized discretion and determine applicant risk. And I also show how mortgage bankers use racialized discretion to interpret property risk, right? So it's not just that they're looking at the applicant's risk. They're also looking at the property and where it's located, specifically its neighborhood. So I saw repeatedly that white mortgage bankers would assume and give the benefit of the doubt to homes in white neighborhoods, assuming they would be low risk. On the other side of that coin, would routinely be suspicious about or concerned about or would place a red flag beside properties located in neighborhoods of color, assuming they were higher risk and would be more likely to more carefully scrutinize that particular application and transaction. So in all of these ways, the mortgage bankers, really, especially the white mortgage bankers, in fact, were facilitating this housing inequality behind the scenes in ways that home buyers and sellers just were not able to observe, were not privy to.
No, thank you for taking us inside that process. So finally, then we have the appraisers, and these are people who determine a home's value. And you say how they all pretty much use the sales comparison approach, or when they determine a home's value by comparing it to previously sold homes located in the same neighborhood or in the same area. Now, there's a pretty explicit racist history behind the appraiser industry, which would be great if you went into a little bit, but you also show how appraisers today, post fair housing laws, still use a racist appraisal logic as well as racist methods to determine home value, resulting in the highest valued homes being concentrated in white neighborhoods and the lowest valued homes to be concentrated in non-white neighborhoods. So how do these professionals appraise the value of housing, and what are the consequences of their appraisal?
Sure. So I'll start with some of the history, like you mentioned, Richard. So part of the history of the appraisal industry is explicitly tied in to the sort of the formulation of the Federal Housing Administration and sort of the systematizing of how do we assess risk and how do we assess value for homes if we're going to be increasingly backing these sort of mortgage loans to ensure that greater numbers of Americans, specifically white Americans, can access home ownership. And Frederick Babcock, who is one of the sort of the architects of the modern appraisal industry, in very close sort of relationship with the federal government, helped really create these explicitly racist appraisal logics and methods that are still used today, just with this sort of explicit reference to racial categories removed. So I'll walk you through some of the common or the some of the major dynamics that I saw in kind of the history of the appraisal industry, and then in the present, and when I did ethnographic work and interviews with appraisers. So the three things that I talk about are that are related from both the history and then the contemporary reality. The first one is that homogeneity or uniformity, and especially uniform or homogeneous neighborhoods, that those neighborhoods are the most desirable. That's sort of the first sort of logical underpinning. The second one, and this was explicitly stated in the historical sort of handbooks and guidelines and training manuals and so on, was that white or high income neighborhoods were considered homogeneous and free from adverse influences and were therefore the most desirable and the most valuable. And then the third one is this notion that that the race and class characteristics of the home buyer or seller should match the race or class race and class characteristics of the neighborhood. And this was related to a phrase that I use in the book called the typical buyer approach. So those three things are still present in the appraisal industry today. They're just not stated in explicitly racist terms. So still today in federal underwriting and appraisal training materials, neighborhood uniformity is considered a metric for determining neighborhood and home value and desirability. Another one, which is related to the sort of the idea of like white and high income neighborhoods being the most desirable homogenous neighborhoods, is still today this idea that neighborhoods are either free from or subject to adverse influences. And the list of adverse influences that the federal underwriting guidelines and sort of appraisal training manuals and so on use are remarkably similar to the ones that are used, that were used back in the early and mid 20th century. In fact, some of them are exactly the same, and many of them lend themselves not only to be sort of indirectly racialized through their reference to like systemic racial inequalities. So like environmental hazards, for instance, which of course, as we know, environmental hazards are not evenly distributed across neighborhoods, right? That neighborhoods of color in particular have been harmed by environmental hazards and the intentional location of environmental hazards in neighborhoods of color. So that's the second one. And then the third one that's still in play today is this notion of the typical buyer, which encourages appraisers to imagine who the home buyer would be for this home and what sort of market that buyer represents. And in doing so, for each of those three sort of logical underpinnings, the appraisers in my study actively chose comps, which is sort of the method, and I'll get into that in a minute, but the method that they used was sort of underpinned by these three logical, I guess, legs. This is the legs that the methods stand on. So the methods that appraisers use, there's one predominant method that they use for residential appraising, and it's been the same since the 1930s, and that's the sales comparison approach. And the sales comparison approach, again, this was part of the original sort of architecture of the appraisal industry, was really explicitly intended to tie the individual home's value to its surrounding neighborhood. And that's why the logical underpinnings became so important for Babcock and the federal government, and why they were tied to these notions of neighborhood desirability and so on through this racialized lens. And so the sales comparison approach means you have an individual home, it's for sale. And the way that that appraisers try to assess the home's value is they look at other homes within that neighborhood, that same neighborhood, and that have sold pretty recently, if possible. And they look at those sort of recent sales, and they compare those recent sales to the home that's for sale that they're trying to evaluate. And they make a variety of adjustments for home size and quality and so on and so forth for location and other aspects that they build into their reports. But what I found was that appraisers actively interpreted each of these sort of logical underpinnings, the uniformity of the neighborhood, adverse influences, and typical buyers through a racialized lens. They just didn't record racial categories or explicit racism on the forms that they had to submit, right? So they actively thought about white neighborhoods, uniform white neighborhoods as the most desirable, and racially heterogeneous or even architecturally heterogeneous neighborhoods as undesirable or less desirable. They also assumed white neighborhoods to be free from adverse influences. They assumed that neighborhoods of color would have lots of adverse influences. And they also used the typical buyer logic in a racialized way. So they would assume that white buyers would want to buy in white neighborhoods and that Black buyers would want to buy in Black neighborhoods, that Latinx buyers would want to buy in Latinx neighborhoods. And if those characteristics did not match, and we've seen a lot of cases of this coming up in the news recently. So for instance, if there was a Black home buyer coming in, this is one of the examples in the book, a Black home buyer wanted to purchase a home and the white real estate agent asked the appraiser to draw lower comps and the appraiser precisely because they didn't want the Black home buyer coming in to purchase the home because, again, that typical buyer logic. So throughout all of this, the appraisal industry continues to be explicitly racialized, just not officially racialized. And so in some of the quantitative aspects of the chapter, I draw on some work I've done with Dr. Junia Howell, and we show how these sort of racializing influences of appraisers and the appraisal industry and federal underwriting guidelines that encourage a sort of racialized lens actually matter. So it's not just the history of appraisal inequality that matters. It's that the history carries forward into the present. And in the present, appraisers in the appraisal industry continue to use home buyer race and neighborhood race, even home seller race, as part of their calculations of home value, part of their understandings of uniformity or lack thereof, part of their understandings of adverse influences, and part of their understanding of who typical buyers are and who should be purchasing a home in a neighborhood. It should be, I'm doing air quotes, who they think should be purchasing a home in a particular neighborhood.
Wow, thank you. This is such a hidden part of the industry and of the process, but has such important consequences. Now, a book like this is perfect for policy recommendations, which you set up quite nicely by, throughout the book, you set it up by presenting the perspectives and the practices of these race breakers, the folks within the industry who use this people-oriented market rubric. So what are you proposing can be done to address racism and thereby address systemic racial inequality in the housing industry among these professionals with the consequence of hopefully making housing fairer?
Yes. So I structured the policy chapter basically under sort of three major categories of policy recommendations. The first major category is monitoring, monitoring housing market professionals. So for instance, housing developers, particularly for-profit housing developers, are virtually unmonitored and unregulated. They don't have to have any professional licensure. They do have to, you know, file things at this like city planning and permitting and so on for, you know, environmental reasons and infrastructural reasons. But they don't have to take any fair housing training. They don't have any sort of particular consequences or threat of consequences for the kinds of racist behaviors that they engage in. So even though I saw a lot of sort of racism amongst the real estate agents in my study, at least some of them were aware of the potential consequences of some of their actions. Housing developers, on the other hand, had no such awareness because they didn't need to. They were basically unmonitored when it came to the kinds of practices, social and particularly racial and economic practices they were engaging in. So I encourage, for instance, a more and better monitoring of housing market professionals. I also, the second major category of policy recommendations that I discuss were basically legal approaches. And what I really tried to do in that section of the policy chapter was draw attention to the ways that perhaps fair housing lawyers or other housing advocates could begin to think about creatively sort of discovering or finding evidence of discrimination in the housing market, for hopefully finding new ways to think about disparate impact discrimination and the kinds of claims that could be made, and really to hopefully sort of broaden the the range of folks that they're sort of investigating, right? So recently, I've had the opportunity to speak to several lawyers who are working on fair housing cases related to appraisers. And I'm really thrilled about that. I was hoping that would be one of the sort of outcomes of the book, right? That there would be more attention to a sort of a wider cast of housing market professionals. Because as you noted, and for many years, many of these actors have been largely hidden or at least uninvestigated. And then the third major category of policy recommendations falls under what I call direct intervention, right? So directly intervening in housing market practices that help produce and reproduce racial inequality in housing and racial segregation. So some of these recommendations will be pretty easy to implement. For instance, one of the recommendations is to actually stop using market area maps. And I didn't talk about this earlier when I was talking about real estate agents, but one of the sort of organizational level dynamics that happens today is that real estate brokerages and real estate boards rely on market area maps that they construct. And in Houston, I found that the construction of these market area map was racially and spatially unequal, right? So white neighborhoods were sort of specialized, unique, and much smaller areas, whereas neighborhoods of color, specifically Black and Latinx neighborhoods, were just their heterogeneity was just flattened, right? And the number of people that lived in Black and Latinx market areas was much higher. We're talking like tens of thousands of people more living in Black and Latinx market areas than in white market areas. And again, that's a real estate board organizational practice that's common across the United States. They could be done away with. Like, what's the purpose of a market area map, right? It's one could argue that it's specifically to delineate delineate urban space by race. And I don't think that would actually be a good aim for any sort of organization interested in maintaining its veneer of fair housing and equal housing opportunity to continue to do. Some of the suggestions I make in the policy recommendation, the last policy recommendation section, would be very difficult to do. And by difficult, I mean there may or may not be the political will to do them. So for instance, I actually recommend just abolishing the sales comparison approach, right? Like, this approach was explicitly intended to ensure that homes in white neighborhoods continue to accrue value and appreciate in value over time. It was specifically created to ensure that homes in white in neighborhoods of color did not. And that's precisely what it has functioned to do and what it continues to do today. Even if there were not the sort of ongoing sort of racialized lens and the racialized logics of contemporary appraisers, which there is, and I document that extensively, the historic influence of the sales comparison approach into today's housing market should be enough, in my opinion, to abolish its use. And I also advocate for really trying to do some of this, particularly the valuation. What does valuation mean when most of that land is stolen anyways? And how do we bring tribes and tribal sovereignty into this conversation of land and valuation processes? So yeah, they range the gamut there from more doable and probably wouldn't make much difference to more of a sort of an abolitionist approach. But I'm hoping that at least some of them will sort of gain traction.
Well, thank you for these very well thought out, well-informed recommendations. As you show, this system was truly designed to work in a very particular way. So hopefully people in positions to make certain changes to it hear about these recommendations and follow them. So, Elizabeth, you've been very generous with your time today, but before we finish, please tell us what you're working on now. And I recognize that this is a bit of a mean question because you just finished the whole book and I'm asking you what's next. So what do you got?
Sure. So I'll tell you about a couple of things I'm working on. I'm actually working on another book with Dr. Sarah Mayorga. I'm really excited about this particular project. We are looking at neighborhood reputation and the social construction of neighborhood reputation, specifically as a mechanism of racial capitalism and the production of neighborhood inequality. And we're using, which true to my genre, I guess, we're using in-depth interviews and ethnographic fieldwork as sort of the empirical backbone of that project, which is under advanced contract with the University of Chicago Press. And then I'm also working on a separate project that centers rental property management and focuses on rental markets and rental inequalities. That is a mixed methods project. I'm using a variety of data sets that are already existing, including the American Housing Survey and the Rental Housing Finance Survey, restricted data, as well as qualitative data collected in two different research sites. And really what we're hoping to do with that project is sort of broaden understanding of renters' experiences of the rental process to include Asian, American Indian, Latinx, Black, and White renters in understudied places, as well as the title might suggest, property managers, who I think are an understudied intermediary that matter a great deal in terms of how rental markets and rental inequality are experienced.
Awesome. Well, you got a wonderful book. These are two really great sounding projects. Best of luck to them. And hopefully you'll come back and be able to discuss one of those or both of those new books when they come out.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.